President Biden speaks on Holocaust Remembrance Day.
This ancient hatred of Jews didn't begin with the Holocaust. It didn't end with the Holocaust either. Or after, even after our victory in World War II.
Plus, Israeli universities have an offer for Jewish American students who are feeling uncomfortable in their own colleges.
The University of Haifa and other Israeli universities are offering American Jewish students and faculty the opportunity to transfer to Israeli academic institutions.
And later, a discussion about ongoing ceasefire talks, a look at Russian claims of training with tactical nuclear weapons, and are American and French troops headed to Nigeria? Today is Tuesday, May 7th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Medical staff rushed to treat Palestinian casualties at a local hospital in Rafah on Tuesday. This as the Israeli military seized control of the border crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, and its tanks pushed into the southern Gazan city of Rafah. Mohammed Abu Skil is a doctor there. He says that the closing of the border crossing will further deteriorate the health of residents, and it will be more difficult to obtain medical supplies. Also on Tuesday, President Joe Biden spoke in commemoration of Holocaust Remembrance Day.
During these sacred days of remembrance, we grieve, we give voice to the 6 million Jews who were systematically targeted and murdered by the Nazis and their collaborators during World War II. We honor the memory of victims, the pain of survivors, the bravery of heroes who stood up to Hitler's unspeakable evil, and we recommit to heeding and heeding the lessons that one of the darkest chapters in human history to revitalize and realize the responsibility of never again.
He tied the past to the present.
This ancient hatred of Jews didn't begin with the Holocaust. It didn't end with the Holocaust either, or after, even after our victory in World War II. This hatred continues to lie deep in the hearts of too many people in the world and requires our continued vigilance and outspokenness. That hatred was brought to life on October 7th in 2023. On the sacred Jewish holiday, the terrorist group Hamas unleashed the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust.
While he made no new policy statements, he did reiterate his statements from last week that free speech is valued and protected, but violence is not. He went on to highlight his administration's efforts to combat anti-Semitism, but did not make any statements beyond the references to October 7th on the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. Meanwhile, reports of possible progress on a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas are happening against the backdrop of Israel's plan for a larger military incursion into Rafah. In Washington, President Joe Biden met with Jordan's King Abdullah and spoke to Israel's leader by phone in an apparent effort to soothe tensions. VOA's Anita Powell has the story.
Tension in Rafah after Israel signaled its intention, over Washington's objections, to launch a ground assault on the packed town at Gaza's southern point. And tension in Washington amid reports that Israel and Hamas were close to a ceasefire deal Monday. Jordan's King lunched privately Monday with U.S. President Joe Biden, and the administration said Gaza was discussed. Biden also called Israel's leader by phone Monday morning. The White House said its wishes are clear. John Kirby is a communications advisor for the White House National Security Council.
We want to get these hostages out. We want to get a ceasefire in place for 6 weeks. We want to increase humanitarian assistance. And the last thing that I want to do is say anything at this podium that's going to put that process at risk.
In Gaza, residents celebrated at Monday's news that Hamas had accepted an Egyptian Qatari ceasefire proposal. The State Department was more skeptical about whether a deal had, in fact, been reached. Matthew Miller is the State Department spokesperson.
Ceasefire is absolutely achievable. There has been a deal on the table, a proposal on the table that would achieve an immediate ceasefire and the release of hostages. Now, as for Hamas's response, which I think gets to your question, again, I don't want to characterize it in any sort of detail until we've had a chance to review it in depth and talk with our partners in the region about it.
Meanwhile, Israel's military has told Rafah residents to evacuate ahead of a ground operation. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari is an Israeli military spokesman. He says the Israeli military examines every answer and reply very seriously and finds every possibility regarding the negotiations for the return of the hostages as quickly as possible. At the same time, he says, the military continues its operations in the Gaza Strip and will continue to do so. The United Nations expressed concerns over an incursion into Rafah. Stefan Dujarric is a spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
Any escalation of hostilities resulting from a full-scale incursion into Rafah will push residents and displaced people currently living there past their breaking point.
And the White House expressed concerns about civilians after what appeared to be aerial strikes there on Monday. Kirby again.
It doesn't matter whether it's missiles or rockets, things that kill innocent people, that's not okay. And again, the president made it clear that we don't want to see operations in Rafah that put at risk those 1.5 million people that are there.
It's those people who today are caught in the middle of all this. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Monday was a confusing rally of what at first looked like Hamas accepting a peace deal, followed by the clarification that it was in fact a new proposal and not the deal already on the table. As expectations rise and fall and conditions on the ground are constantly changing, I'm joined by Brian Katulis, the Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Middle East Institute.
Well, I think the latest action has been more focused on Israel's military action, where they took the border crossing between Egypt and Gaza and Rafah and took control of it. And that's, I think, a key movement and action. It does relate to these negotiations, because the negotiations that are underway are not just about a temporary ceasefire that would last 6 weeks or the release of hundreds of people, whether they're Israeli hostages held in Gaza or Palestinian prisoners. They're tough negotiations because they're about setting the framework and the contours for a long-lasting end to this conflict. And there's multiple phases that are in discussion. Differences of views. Hamas wants a longer term period and wants the ceasefire to be more permanent in their view. Israel wants to maintain the right to go after Hamas leaders, which it sees as responsible for the attacks on October 7th that started this war. So what I think we're seeing here and what we saw over the last day or so is the public surfacing of a dynamic that's been underway for several weeks, if not months. In these negotiations, and I think it's some sign, it offers some sign that perhaps they're getting close to some sort of agreement, but it could take some time for it all to play out.
And what's your best guess as to what that agreement looks like?
You know, that's the hard thing to really estimate, because it involves the current Israeli government's calculus, which is quite divided, as well as Hamas as a movement. But my best guess is that we're likely to get to some sort of short-term ceasefire that lasts for about a month or so, leads to the release of maybe a third of the hostages that are still in Gaza. There's still some questions about how many of those hostages are still alive. But I think the safest bet is that if they get a deal, it'll be something that'll be more modest rather than sweeping. It'll be something that's probably still vulnerable to additional episodes of war and conflict, and something that's quite tenuous, in part not because that's what I want, but it's just the conditions and the differences between the parties. And I think that's where we're at right now.
It's being reported that some of what Hamas has rejected was even some of their own language that they put forward into a previous offer. And we know that on the Israeli side, Netanyahu is really held up by this right-wing coalition that doesn't seem to want a ceasefire. They want to go after Hamas. Are both sides negotiating in good faith?
That's a good question. I think Hamas has an interest in seeing its own survival, right? Its leaders not get killed. So I think they'll use every tactic, whether it's to be genuine and throw actual offers on the table or to use smoke and mirrors to try to keep more time on the clock for them. I think the Israeli government has a similarly complicated situation. And it's not only because of some right-wing members of the government who want to see the Rafah military operation against Hamas go forward. There's also on the other side of the ledger some members of this emergency coalition that have demanded that Israel move to a hostage release as quickly as possible. As we've seen over the last couple of weeks, people turning out in large numbers in the streets in Israel wanting their hostages to come home. So there's multiple pressures here. And the key point, I think, is that both Israel and Hamas, the two main combatants, have a strong degree of internal divisions amongst its leaders about what it wants to actually achieve. And this is the sort of thing, the devil's in the details. If for those calling for a ceasefire now, it's not just like someone can wave a magic wand. The challenge that Bill Burns, the CIA director, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, have right now, along with the other mediators from Qatar and Egypt, is to try to get the alignment of interests through diplomacy between these two main parties that are divided to get to some sort of agreement that ends the violence. And that's why it's taken essentially 5 months of on-again, off-again negotiations since the last temporary ceasefire to get to this point. Whether it succeeds and whether the parties are being genuine, I think that's still a very much an open question.
Brian Katulis with the Middle East Institute. Mr. Katulis, thanks so much for your time this morning. I appreciate your analysis.
Thanks for having me.
It was announced on Monday that Columbia University in New York, one of the epicenters for the anti-war student protests in the U.S., will cancel its graduation ceremony due to security concerns. Meanwhile, academic institutions in Israel say they're making plans to welcome students who want to leave American universities as campus protests against Israel's war in Gaza may cause many American Jewish students to say they feel uncomfortable. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel protests at American universities are causing some Jewish students to feel uncomfortable on their campuses. Maya Resnick is a student in a dual degree program between Tel Aviv University and Columbia University in New York, where she's slated to start later this year. But the anti-Israel protests have caused her to rethink the move.
I find it upsetting and disturbing and a little bit frightening for when I go, just knowing that already being a member of this program, I will have, I'm just under extra scrutiny. And like, there are a lot of my peers motioning for my program to be removed. So it's just an overall feeling that I am not so welcome.
Some Jewish students at Columbia who identify as pro-Israel and demonstrate in support of the Israeli hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza report that they have been harassed. Melissa Seidek is a social work student at Columbia University.
Jewish people were assaulted. I myself was also harassed. A person was yelling at me, screaming at me, calling me a Zionist and a murderer. We feel right now the campus has been overtaken by a rather extreme ideology. And I think it's so sad because a lot of us really care about the idea of like Palestinian liberation and a free Palestine.
Some Israeli academics say that the pro-Palestinian encampments around the U.S. do not recognize the complexity of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. David Barak Gorodetsky is the chair of the Ruderman Program for American Jewish Studies at the University of Haifa.
What we need to do as the state of Israel and as Israeli universities is we need to offer a place where a nuanced discussion of Israel and of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can take place.
The University of Haifa and other Israeli universities are offering American Jewish students and faculty the opportunity to transfer to Israeli academic institutions, either temporarily or permanently. The prestigious Technion Israel Institute of Technology is accelerating plans for a one-year preparatory program for American students that will include intensive Hebrew in addition to technological studies. The Technion has already received dozens of requests for information about the program. Ori Sivan, the president of the Technion, told VOA that American Jewish students and faculty are welcome.
We offer them the opportunity of spending time here. As students, they can either integrate into our studies. Especially, it is especially easy in our graduate school. As faculty, we offer them the opportunity to spend time here, join existing research, bring their research in, collaborate with our students, collaborate with our faculty.
As students go home for the summer, the anti-Israel encampments could dissipate. But even if there is a ceasefire in Gaza, some Jewish students worry that the anti-Israel attitudes could linger. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. There's controversy brewing in Nigeria as some fear that American and French troops might soon be stationed there. That story coming up. Now, though, to the war in Ukraine. Russian officials have announced new tactical nuclear weapons drills, but the U.S. and Ukraine see no evidence of them. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces are losing more territory while they wait for a large delivery of U.S. aid. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
On Monday, May 6, the Russian Ministry of Defense reported that Russian President Vladimir Putin instructed the Russian General Staff to prepare to conduct exercises to practice the preparation and use of tactical nuclear weapons. Experts from the Institute for the Study of War believe the Kremlin appears to be re-intensifying a reflective control campaign targeting Western decision-making using nuclear threats and diplomatic manipulation. Andriy Yusev, a representative of the Ukrainian intelligence, commented on the Russian new nuclear threats, saying that nuclear blackmail is a consistent practice of the Putin regime. But is anything actually happening in Russia? Yusev added that at the moment Ukrainian intelligence does not observe any new actions apart from the statements and discussions around them. Pentagon spokesman Patrick Ryder called the statements of the Russian side an example of irresponsible rhetoric that we have seen from Russia before. Ryder also emphasized that the United States does not observe changes in the strategic location of Russian forces, but will continue to monitor the situation. Meanwhile, Russian forces made a notable tactical advance northwest of Avdiivka in the past couple of days. Experts of the Institute for the Study of War assume this is likely following a Ukrainian decision to withdraw from the area on May 3rd. Experts suggest Ukrainian forces may have decided to trade space for time as they await the arrival of massive U.S. aid to the front in the coming weeks. President Zelensky said in his latest address that Ukrainian forces are getting ready for the upcoming battles. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Fighting is expected to get worse in Myanmar as rebels are trying to hold back columns of reinforcements sent by the country's ruling military junta to try to reclaim Miawadi, a critical trading post near the Thai border. Myanmar has been plunged into a bloody chaos since the military coup in February of 2021 led to the rise of an armed resistance that is now working alongside ethnic minority rebel groups. Both the junta and the resistance have just a limited window to make gains or hold their ground as monsoon rains begin rolling across Myanmar around early June, making fighting much more difficult. Many people, particularly Rohingya refugees, have fled Myanmar for neighboring Bangladesh, and that's where the UN Agency on Migration released its annual report on Tuesday. Conflict and climate change remain the most significant factors driving global migration. This according to the annual report from the International Organization for Migration, or IOM. Amy Pope is the Director General.
Now, climate change is driving more new displacement than ever before, but the biggest problem is still conflict. We see that here in Bangladesh, where nearly a million Rohingya people have been forced to flee their homes because of ongoing conflict in their home country. And I met many of these people yesterday when I visited Cox's Bazar. But we also see that the impact on the neighboring countries, many of which are facing their own development challenges, can reverse development gains.
Pope was in Dhaka for the launch of the report on Tuesday. The report showed a record number of displaced people worldwide. Additionally, the report underscored the significance of international migration for economic growth, with international remittances, that's the money sent back to home countries, having surged over 650%, climbing from $128 billion in 2000 to $831 billion in 2022. And we'll end today's show in West Africa. A coalition of civil society groups in Nigeria is warning authorities against signing any defense pacts with the United States or France that would allow them to redeploy troops being expelled from countries in the Sahel region. Timothy Obezu reports from Abuja.
The coalition, without providing evidence, accused the United States and France of lobbying authorities in the Gulf of Guinea countries, especially Nigeria, to redeploy troops expelled from the Sahel states. It said the alleged move could have, quote, wide-ranging implications for defense and internal security, end quote, and that hosting a military base in Nigeria could potentially divert state funds and resources away from important local projects like education, healthcare, and infrastructure development. Kabiru Adamu, founder of Beacon Security and Intelligence Limited, says the letter has a political undertone.
It looked like it was just based on the desire to create a political outcome. There is no fact supporting the allegation that either the US or France has approached Nigeria for the establishment of a base anywhere in Nigeria, even though that is likely to happen. Of course, because we've seen the influence of both countries reducing in the Sahel region, and Nigeria would offer a likely fallback option for both countries, especially for the U.S.
The coalition also said the alleged plan to set up a U.S. military base in northern Nigeria could worsen regional tensions with neighbors, cause a notable environmental impact, and worsen the high cost of living for the local population. Nigerian authorities have yet to respond to the letter. The U.S. and French militaries have been operating in Africa's Sahel for many years, helping the region in its fight against terrorism. But a wave of coups in recent years has strained that relationship, with military juntas accusing foreign powers of being overbearing without significant progress against jihadist militants. Some juntas have instead turned toward Russia for help fighting the armed groups. Adamu cautions the letter might be an example of Russian propaganda.
There is also the possibility that we are seeing the propaganda machinery by Russia and Niger playing out in this regard. We know that since the coup in Niger, the coupist and Russia has been engaged in massive propaganda.
Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.